Diverse authorities have speculated. Why is it that the common mass of people so adore the rotten, the awful, the trite? In a remote laboratory, two genuine warlocks, Ben R. Williams and Greg Morrison, will look popular taste dead in the eye and hold a scalpel to its bloated gullet. They will read America's most popular books. They will ridicule the New York Times bestseller list. They will destroy their reputations and follow a terrible book even into a rotting grave. This, good people, is cannon fodder.
I'm not a man, I'm a destroyer. I'm not a man, I'm a destroyer.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Ben R. Williams.
And I'm Greg Morrison.
And welcome to episode 14 of Cannon Fodder.
Merry Christmas!
God bless us, everyone. So, we were originally going to be doing Eat, Pray, Love, but we decided that, you know, Christmas time is right around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
By the time you hear this, it may even be past. So we decided to do a Christmas kind of book. We read The Christmas Sweater by Glenn Beck.
Yeah, it's a novel.
It's
that's what the cover says anyway.
Yeah, don't believe its lies.
Yeah.
Before we get into that, Greg, what books have you read lately?
Oh, well, I think I kind of lost track here and there. No, yeah, you know, I've been reading some pretty cool stuff. I actually read a pretty interesting book about fairy tales called From the Beast to the Blonde, which had interesting tidbits, but it was a little goofy. And right now, I am reading a beloved book, well, not by me, but by many people. Like, I like it, but, you know, mm-hmm. called I Capture the Castle by Dodie Smith. She wrote 101 Dalmatians as well.
Oh.
And, yeah, also reading a pretty cool nonfiction book about the history of homes, like mm-hmm. domestic comforts. It's by Bill Bryson, the guy who did the A Walk in the Woods and stuff.
Okay.
And ran away to England.
He's going outside of his comfort zone on this one.
Yeah.
Talking about houses.
Yeah. What about you? What have you been reading?
I've read a couple of books. I read a very interesting book to me called The Little Blue-Eyed Vampire from Hell by a guy named Richard Ellis. It's a book about Vampirotuthis infernalis, the vampire squid.
Yeah.
Which isn't really a squid nor an octopus. It's something sort of a creature somewhere between the two. It was pretty interesting. It talked about the vampire squid, but also other cephalopods. And that's, for whatever reason, that's right up my alley. I really enjoyed that.
Well, out of curiosity, did they make like a different genus for it or something? Or
yeah, it belongs to its own family. It's
oh, wow.
the only member of that family. If I'm
There's
not
nothing
mistaken.
In like the archaeological record. Well, I mean, I guess something like that wouldn't really leave a lot of stuff behind.
Yeah, it does. Let's see. It does have the, it's been a little while since I've read it, so I've already forgotten all the important details.
Little known fact, it's not the Christmas episode, it's the cephalopod episode.
Yeah. Merry Christmas.
Squid Town.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm trying to remember now. I think that it diverged from the octopus and squid ancestors, such as the cuttlefish and the nautilus. I think the nautilus is pretty much the most ancient cephalopod that's still around.
Hmm.
Some would argue the coolest, but not me. I'm not into that sort of controversy. Also read a book called The Passage by Justin Cronin,
okay,
which was interesting enough and not quite frustrating enough that I will probably read the second book in this trilogy.
Okay.
Sort of a modern take on vampires, a vampire apocalypse by a guy who was known as a hard-lit kind of guy, even compared to Cormac McCarthy,
hmm.
who wrote this vampire book. Loved the first couple hundred pages, then it jumps 90 years into the future, and I wasn't quite as fond of that. But if you're looking for a new take on the vampire thing, give it a read.
Yeah?
all 700, 800 pages. Yeah.
Just flip through it.
Yeah.
Casually.
Yeah. this, it should probably be said as well, before we get into this episode, that if I seem a little bit low energy on this episode, I'm recuperating from one of the worst illnesses I've ever faced. About, 72 hours ago, I was wondering if I would in fact need to go to the emergency room, so it's a pretty remarkable turnaround, but still might not make for the most compelling listening experience ever.
Well, I mean, you got Glenn Beck, you got a sweater, and you got Christmas. I mean, that's the trio. You don't need anything more than that. Well, I guess what were your expectations going into this, Ben?
I expected this to be easily digestible pap. I expect it to be just your standard, treacly, heartwarming, sentimentality Christmas stuff. Though, coming from Glenn Beck, I also expected it to have some sort of really hard-edged, conservative-slash-libertarian bent, which it did not have as much. There were a couple examples.
Not really.
What were your expectations going in, Greg?
Well, little known fact, well, to our listeners who don't know us at all, my father, for a long time, suffered from a tremendous enthusiasm for Glenn Beck.
Really?
Yeah, the Glenn Beck show and all that stuff, where like he'd write on the fucking chalkboard, and, mm-hmm. here's the awful octopus of liberalism, and that kind of thing, and mm-hmm. The genealogy of progressivism and stuff like that. So, I'm pretty well used to the tone and methods and all that sort of stuff. I expected something that would be really, really, really sentimental and really gruesome. Mm-hmm. because, and I don't say this to be like cutting or anything like that, but I find that a lot of people who have gone through a substance abuse problem or like had something really awful happen to them, then like they refer to it very casually. And Glenn Beck does that a lot. Like, he talks a lot about, like, well, I'm a failure. I'm a fuck-up. I'm an idiot. Mm-hmm. Which a lot of people read as humility. But, in fact, to me at least, seems to be kind of like a weird, guilt-ridden self-lashing. Mm-hmm. I think that a lot of his ambition, not to get too much into character assassination, a lot of his ambition may stem from sort of guilt-ridden trauma at an early age.
Well, I think that there are some authors where you have to say, well, we have to look at the book aside from the person who wrote it. But I don't think this is one of those cases, and I think we should talk about Glenn Beck. And I will say, if NASA came to me and said, Ben, we're working on this program. We're going to launch 5 people into the core of the Earth's sun. And we need 5 names from you. Top 5. I'm not saying Glenn Beck would be number 1. But odds are pretty good he'd be on that list.
He makes the list. Yeah.
Now, I want to clarify this because I think a lot of people hear that and say, oh, well, Ben, you old liberal. How's that socialism working out? No. All right. My hatred for Glenn Beck has surprisingly little to do with his politics. There are plenty of people that I politically disagree with that I'm very dear friends with. That doesn't matter. What I hate about Glenn Beck is that he's a man who has built a career that is, or at least was, very recently, quite successful out of dividing people. That's essentially what he does. He thrives and survives off of making you afraid of your neighbor.
Yeah.
And I think that anybody who profits off of dividing people, I think that's about as close to evil as you can get. And I often wonder, I've heard other people make the claim that, Glenn Beck, he doesn't really believe this shit. It's a character. It's like, well, isn't that even fucking worse?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
However you cut it, I think that what he does is just morally reprehensible. And I think that when people compare him to, the heir apparent to Father Charles Coughlin, I think if anything, Coughlin may have had a more endearing message than Glenn Beck perhaps had once you get rid of the anti-Semitism.
Well, but I mean, if you look at the letter of what Glenn Beck says, if not necessarily the spirit, then you could say the same thing. I mean, he basically is Father Coughlin.
Yeah. Is it Coughlin or Coughlin?
Coughlin, yeah.
Coughlin.
Huh. My great-grandmother was a... It runs in the family. What can I say? My great-grandmother listened to Father Coughlin a lot, and he was invoked regularly, apparently, at things that happened long before my birth. Mm. But yeah, I mean, it is a fine American tradition of, you know, pseudo-preacherdom mm-hmm. crossed with political evangelism, crossed with personal morality tales and everything. I mean, it's nice because it's a soupy mixture that you can feel like an individual and you can feel like your individual sadnesses are being addressed or perhaps even healed at the same time that you get to hate somebody. So, you know, you get your wounds balmed and you get to hate something, which is pretty much the dream, really. Mm-hmm. That's a good date, I think. But I guess we should talk about the book instead of just sort of apostrophizing Glenn Beck.
Well, you know, you shouldn't just hate people unnecessarily unless they're Glenn Beck, who should be torn apart by feral dogs in the street. But yeah, let's talk about this book. So, I guess the synopsis of the book will start out here. We'll go in chronological order. So this book is about a young man named Eddie, who... guess what? It's kind of Glenn Beck. His middle name is Edward. But Eddie is some sort of young proto-Beck growing up in, I guess...
Tadpole Beck.
His hind legs haven't fully formed yet, but he's working on it. So he's a kid growing up in, what, like, early 80s, late 70s, early 80s?
Washington State.
Very
Twin Peaks.
Yeah. And he... All he wants for Christmas... is this bicycle. And I guess a little bit of backstory. So in the book, his father died like a year or so earlier. It was just terrible. It was really hard on him. Father died, that's no good. So his father owned the bakery in town. Bakery closes down, and so mom's struggling to make ends meet.
Well, she sells the bakery, she sells the house, she sells the car, she starts working at some department store.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Tough times.
Tough times.
And all that little Edward wants for Christmas is this bicycle. And he lovingly describes it. It's with a red Huffy with a black banana seat and other things. I don't know a lot about bikes, but, you know, it's got your other standard bike features on it. You know, power windows, AM, FM, all that shit.
Well, you know, that's old wind in the keyhole. You remember it? It said it sounded like a euphemism.
Yeah.
Well, in that fine tradition, banana seat, man. I mean, that doesn't sound no good.
No.
No good at all. The reason why I giggled about that a great deal is that this Eddie character is always wandering around announcing to people that he wants a banana seat. Which, you know, given Glenn Beck's extreme comfort with people who do not like homosexuals, the idea of, you know, oh, I just want to rest my buttocks on a nice firm banana, you know, oh, well, Glenn Beck.
But it better be black. It better be.
Anyway.
It's worth doing right, okay? So he really wants this bicycle.
Bad.
Just feel the vibrations of the road channeling through his torso. But then, what happens, Greg?
Well, so mom, like a bitch, makes him a sweater instead. Mm-hmm. And because it's not what he wants, and because it's handmade, and it reminds him of the fact that he can't have store-bought things, he always has to have handmade things, he gets all pissy and sad, and I don't know if we should go past the premise, or if we should try to go ahead and explain, like, mom dies.
Well, we'll come back to that. We'll come back to that. Mother dies of a broken heart, in a way.
In flames.
Yeah. It's the most dramatic instance of someone dying from a broken heart you've ever seen. But, well, I want to take a moment to talk about this, because there's this big deal made of, you know, well, this kid is an ungrateful shit.
Right.
Because his mother makes him this sweater.
Yeah.
You know, and it's the best she could do. She makes him this sweater, and he's not appreciative.
She could afford the yarn because it was nice yarn.
Nice yarn.
But she couldn't afford the sweater. No. And every 12-year-old boy appreciates a nice yarn, you know?
Exactly. You know, I mean, and the question isn't, is this kid a shitheel? Of course he is.
Right.
The question is, aren't all kids shitheels, really? Who in their right mind would think a 12-year-old kid, like, well, we couldn't get you that bike you've been wanting.
Yeah.
But here's a sweater, and you know what? It's made with love. So, you know, okay, before you're the age of, let's say, 18, you're old enough to die for your country at 18, we'll just call that a safe
benchmark,
safe limit on there. Before that age, you're essentially a larval human being. You're not formed yet.
Tadpole.
And when you're a young person, you do not have the ability to really understand, I think, like, oh, you know, my mom worked really hard on this. Like, now, you know, if someone gives me something like, hey, you know, I made this myself just for you, man, I'd be really honored. I'd be floored. That's cool. That's awesome.
Right.
But when you're 12, that doesn't cut the mustard.
Right.
And when you're 12, too, you know, it's not, what's he going to do, save up his money and go buy the bike? No, it's not the 1800s. It can't be a chimney sweep. He's just got to wait another year.
Yeah.
It's pretty crushing when you're a kid.
Well, you know, I mean, I think it's also just that the way that it is done, and I didn't know if you wanted to go through that, but that, you know, like, the mom, what I would do if I were the parent is, you know, like, oh, I got you this sweater. You know, like, make, you know, give him the sweater. And you know, just because you're a parent and, you know, this person has urinated on you and perhaps shit on you at some point, maybe vomited in your face, you're probably used to them disappointing you or maybe not consciously disappointing you. You know, it's like, it's a kid.
Yeah.
It's not their fault. You know, I'd probably, like, egg them on a little bit and be like, hey, I'll try on that sweater. You know, it would look good as a sweater right now. But then, you know, all the time knowing that you're going to give them the bike.
Yeah.
But instead, it becomes this, like, guilt trip thing. And I think that that's the worst thing, is that when you're a kid, things that strike other adults as selfless and touching, when you're a kid, strike you as sad and, like, they demand your sympathy. It's like, well, your mother worked really, really hard at this. It's like, oh, no, mom's suffering.
Yeah.
Oh, no, and I don't even enjoy this.
Yeah.
It seems like unwanted cruelty.
Yeah. I would agree with that. And too, I mean, you know, if I were the mother in this situation, from the very beginning, I've been very upfront. I said, listen, you know, I know you really want this bike. I have bad news. It's not going to happen.
Right.
Can't do it. Can't swing it. I'm really sorry.
Yeah.
I've got you another gift I'm working real hard on.
Yeah.
But it's not going to be the bike. And right. Don't think this is some sort of fake out, because it's not going to be the bike.
Yeah.
But no, that's not what happens. They even drive past, like, the bike shop. And he sees the bike in the window. It was like days before Christmas, you know, and the mother points at it, like, oh, is that the bike?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the bike I want. Oh, that's the bike, huh? You know, 2 days later, here's your sweater, enjoy. You
yeah.
know? It's like, well, I mean, that's, you know, any kid's going to feel kind of a bait and switch at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, not to say he isn't an ungrateful shit, because he is. But,
right.
You know, I just think any reasonable person in this set of circumstances could not expect the kid to just, oh boy, the sweater! Well, I wanted the bike, but you made me the sweater, and I love it even more. You know?
Yeah. Well, it's an awful way to teach a kid a lesson about maturity. Don't do something where, you know, pleasure has to be bound up with self-sacrifice and misery. You're like, oh, a gift, something you're looking forward to. Compromise. You know, like, I don't know that that's exactly the lesson, A, that you want to give your kid, and B, that it's the best time to bring this issue up.
Yeah.
You know, like you said, you know, you try and spoil the pool a little bit and be like, look, you just, I'm sorry, we can't swing it, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So after he gets the sweater, there are a couple of funny things. Like, he goes up to his room. Glenn Beck lays it on pretty thick.
Yeah.
He goes up to his room, and, you know, earlier it had been snowing, right? Had a white Christmas. He looks out the window, and the first thing he sees is a girl riding by on her new bicycle, having a lot of fun. And then the snow turns to rain.
Yeah.
You know. And then just, yeah, I mean, the clouds might as well just form a fucking frowny face. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, couldn't be laid on any more thickly.
Yeah.
But so then they go to the grandparents' house, which is like a couple hours away or something. This is the Christmas tradition. Go see
the sweater on the floor.
Oh, yeah.
He balls it up. He balls up the sweater, and he drops it on the floor on his way to the window so he can feel sorry for himself. And his mom comes up, and she's like, please, don't treat your sweater like that. I don't know why she's kind of French. Edith Piaf, Glenn Beck's mother. Anyway, so it's another wounding. And then, anyway, they go to the grandparents' house, and then more suffering.
Yeah, yeah. The grandfather, at first, is established as the coolest character in the book, who's this, you know, he teaches little Edward how to... find his presents hidden around the house. And, you know, the grandfather is just kind of this big mischievous kid. And but in like, a wholesome way, which is one thing that kind of pissed me off throughout the book, because there's these references to, like, you know, well, me and Grandpa got in trouble because he took me to, I went on an errand with him to go to the hardware store. Yeah. But we went to the hardware store across town so that we could get ice cream. Yeah, yeah. Grandma was pretty steamed. Oh, heaven forfend. A grandfather wants to spend quality time with his grandson. What a cock.
Well, and soft serve ice cream in particular. Yeah. You know, it's not like, oh, wait in the car, I'm going to have sex with this prostitute. You know, it wasn't anything like that. No, it's just like, oh, we got syrup this time. It took an extra hour. Yeah. It's hard to be terribly mad.
Mm-hmm.
And that was why, like, you know, oh, he's such a rascal.
Mm-hmm.
It was hard to imagine that without thinking that the grandmother was just a reprehensible bitch.
Yeah.
And she wasn't characterized that way. She was just bland, generic grandma who feels sad and wants to feed you.
Yeah. And, or like the time they have this game, which, what do they call it? It's, Stand for God, is that it?
Yeah.
Where, you know, originally they were going to call it Jump for Jesus, but even Grandpa agreed that was too far.
Even that war criminal Grandpa.
Yeah. Yeah. The game is that while they're in church, whenever it's time to stand and sing a hymn or, you know, recite something, that Grandpa and Eddie try to, you know, race to see who can be the first to their feet to do it, and they have so much fun that they have to be separated.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah, God forbid that someone figures out a way that a small child can enjoy church. That's, that's just terrible. I mean, and, you know, it just pisses you off the whole time. I mean, the grandmother has almost no character development whatsoever other than being a long-suffering food preparer, like you said.
Yeah.
So whenever anything like that pops up, it's just, well, she must be awful. What a bitch, man.
Well, that is kind of the Glenn Beck vision of the world, though, is that, you know, women are long-suffering, and women are, or men are mischievous failures. The sitcom, they called it. and it's pretty much the template that we grew up with, where it's like, you know, oh, the dad's the fun one, and oh, he doesn't know what he's doing. Looks like he hit his thumb with a nail and a hammer, I guess. But the mom's the one who pays the taxes around these parts, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think Glenn Beck is playing into, like, a tried-and-true template.
Yeah. So, yes, they get to the grandparents' house. And this is where Eddie just really becomes a horrible shit.
Bottoms out.
Yeah, he decides, you know, he's so disappointed that he didn't get his bicycle, that he just resolves to not have fun anymore for the rest of his life, apparently.
Yeah.
So, you know, Grandpa's like, oh, you want to play Chinese checkers? No.
Fuck off.
Yeah. And so they're going to spend the night, as is their Christmas tradition. And, you know, it seems like there's something that Grandpa's really excited about for the next day. But, old Eddie's not having any of that. He says he's not feeling well.
Wants to go home, play with some of his friends' presents.
Yeah, yeah. So, Grandpa, you know, Eddie and Grandpa sort of play a game of chicken. Like, oh, you don't want to stay here, maybe you should go. Yeah, why don't you just go? So they leave. They're driving back home. And then, you want to take over, Greg?
Well then, since he's all drowsy from being unhappy... he falls asleep, and about 10 minutes later, so does Mom. Mm-hmm. And he wakes up to some gnarled, very strong, but gentle hands pulling him from the wreckage, which apparently is covered in, like, his mother's innards. And, I mean, there's just blood everywhere.
She exploded before she died, son.
All the pain, just...
Have you ever seen The End of Monty Python's The Meaning of Life? It's a regular Mr. Creosote situation.
Some Cronenberg kind of stuff in the middle of this. Yeah, so basically Mom gets mangled. It's no good. And so now he has to go live with the suckheads, his grandparents.
Yeah.
And so, you know, now he's like double unhappy because now both of his parents have cacked out. And
he's killed his mother in a very real way.
Yeah.
It's like one of those things where, you know, everybody's like, Eddie, you know, you didn't kill your mother. You know, you can't feel guilty. Yeah, of course he did. You know, he at least set in motion a chain of events that were easily avoidable that resulted in his mother's death, which is essentially the same, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and, you know, the thing about that is that, like, there's this whole sort of theme throughout the book, and we'll get to why this is brought up and how it's brought up, but Eddie's being a shit over and over again. And the premise is that, like, people that have bad things happen to them, or that especially are abused, think that no one loves them, or think that they can't trust anybody. True. Very true. But, on the other hand, Eddie goes from a relatively happy life. You know, like, his dad's really cool with him, his mom's really cool with him. They both die, which is really shitty.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't go into foster care. He doesn't go live with, like, you know, the Dickensian uncle who rapes him or something. He goes and lives with his grandparents, and the house smells like home-cooked bread and bacon all the time, I think he said.
Yeah.
I'm just like, oh, so it's paradise. So you died and went to heaven.
Yeah.
I mean, I find it hard to believe that it's like, you know, oh, man, I just, oh, my rough and tumble life, I just don't need anybody. Mm-hmm. No, yeah. I don't buy it.
Yeah, well, especially since it's been established that his grandfather is in many ways his best friend.
Yeah, you know, like, exactly.
Well, I mean, it's shitty circumstances that led you there, but, you know, now you have to live in this awesome place with your best pal.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Yeah. From this point on, the book gets more difficult to discuss because so little actually happens for the remaining two-thirds of it.
He meets people.
Yeah.
And he disagrees with other people, but that's about it.
Yeah. The remainder of the book is mainly... Eddie locking horns with his grandfather over and over again, just, you know, Eddie, you gotta quit being angry and sad. No, God's dead! Don't you say that, Eddie. Nah, fuck you!
Yeah.
And that happens like 7 times.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the rest of the book, essentially. And yeah, you just feel, he says just the most devastating things imaginable to his grandfather, just, you know, the most cutting and horrific thing.
I'm glad you lost a daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You never could satisfy your wife. Just awful, awful stuff. But he meets people along the way.
He meets a little rich boy. Mm-hmm.
Taylor.
Taylor. Kind of like the little anemic boy in To Kill a Mockingbird. So basically... Truman Capote resurfaces yet again to haunt American literature. And he also meets the Marlboro Man, who's God, apparently.
Yeah, so there's... we'll come back to Taylor. This guy, Russell. Right? So there's this old abandoned house. And Eddie finds this guy, like, out back. And he's breaking a horse, you know, feeding it apples or something. And the guy is, you know, he's dirty, but he has kind of an earthy cleanliness to him, and there's just something, you know, there's just something really keen about him
that
you can't put your finger on, and something peaceful, and, he's God, he's God, just say it, Glenn Beck, he's God. No, that's apparently a secret, even at the end, that's not revealed. Something everyone in the room knows except Glenn Beck, The moment the fucker shows up, you know he's God.
Yeah.
And so he shows up, and he occasionally talks to Eddie and gives him little nuggets of wisdom about how, you know, the book is full of these bland bits of wisdom of, you know, well, sometimes when people are running away from a thing, it's really from themselves.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes the hardest part of the journey is knowing that you're there at the end of the trip. And so he just says a lot of shit like that that really has no meaning. And,
yeah.
But somehow it gives this kid comfort. You know? He shows up later. We'll get to that.
Well, he also, one thing that kind of surprised me, so he's obviously God from the minute that he steps on the scene, because he knows all these details about Eddie.
Yeah.
And nobody can ever find him. Nobody ever knows who he is. Which I was surprised that when he comes home and starts telling his grandparents, like, the only person who understands me is Russell. And Russell lives next door in the abandoned house.
Yeah.
That, like, no one was concerned, you know. That, well, they say, like, oh, they're going to go look for Russell.
Mm-hmm.
But they never have, like, a witch hunt for Russell. They never think, like, oh, Eddie suffered severe trauma, so he's conjuring up weird people to talk to him. Mm-hmm. It's always just, you know, oh, I guess you know a person then. Huh.
Yeah.
But Russell does encourage him in his perhaps cockiest behavior at certain points. Because Eddie will be talking about, like, you know, well, you know who's shitty is my grandpa. Because my grandpa doesn't even realize how much he doesn't have. He's just thankful for what he's got. And God humors him and is like, you know, oh, yeah, well, tell me more. You know, your grandpa, he really doesn't have it all figured out. You 12-year-old, you really know what's up. And starts sort of building up his ego and everything. And I guess that's just sort of Russell trying to bring him to a crisis point, you know, digitally manipulating him. Yeah. But
well, when I read that, my assumption was, you know, oh, well, he's giving him all this stuff so that Eddie will look back later and say, oh, well, maybe Russell was really just being hydrochlorically sarcastic.
Yeah,
you got it figured out, kid. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Boy, you ought to teach your grandpa a thing or two, you son of a bitch.
So anyway, so he meets two ends of the economic spectrum, two ends of the peace spectrum. So you got poor God on the one hand, and then you got rich, sad boy on the other hand, Taylor.
Taylor
Ashton.
You know, since Glenn Beck is a very, very rich person, and you know, you would think that he would know what rich people are like. but I love the comments. I mean, you know, there are people like this, but it's so over the top.
Yeah.
There are scenes like the very first time that Eddie meets Taylor, he, like, goes out to dinner with the family, you know, Taylor's family, and the parents say, you know, oh, well, Taylor, you know, you want to go to Disneyland this summer? Oh, no, not Disneyland. Not that place again. I'm tired of that.
Yeah.
So, oh, come on. Just don't.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know. The picture that was sort of conjured up for me, and this may be just because, you know, of the environment in which I read it, I sort of imagined him as being like in the Harold and Maude family, you know, like in this giant house, and just really quiet and sad, and like, you know, his mother's always hassling him or something. But, I mean, to that end, you know, a lot of his characters, a lot of Glenn Beck's character drawing seems derived almost exclusively from the pop culture ether. There is not, I don't think, a single observed live human being in this book.
No.
At least not within the context that makes them who they are. Mm-hmm. In which sense you could say that they're not really real. And there, like, there's this fascination with, like, TV and movies and stuff like that that only peeks through, I think, because he had two co-authors on this, which is frightening.
Wait, really?
Yeah. It says Glenn Beck with, and then, like, two other dudes. Yeah.
Good Lord.
Yeah. And when he sees his vision of paradise at the end, he refers to the colors being, like, technicolor, and that, like, it was a photographic reverse of hell and all this stuff and things like that, and there's just a lot of things. It's a very media-conscious book when it tries to be the most genuine and uninflected. You know, like, at the moments where it's supposed to be, like, spontaneous emotion, it is obviously replicating something from a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was sort of revealing that, like, the most sincere emotion that I felt in the entire book was when he sneaks down to watch The Tonight Show by himself. And, like, it's the only time he doesn't feel alone. Like, he's just, you know, with this glowing tube, and it's Johnny and Ed and all this stuff, and he actually feels at home, he feels like he's welcome, and he watches it until, you know, the test pattern comes up and all that stuff. I actually felt like I was hearing something that had happened.
Yeah.
But everything else just was schmaltz.
It is telling that you have a book with the main character is the author's self-insertion, and that character feels least like a human being of all the characters in the book.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, they say, you know, that many sociopaths are able to function in the world by not experiencing human emotion, but successfully aping it. Not that I'm saying Glenn Beck is a sociopath, but we would never suggest these things.
No.
But yeah, there is quite a bit of that. I remember there are several instances to, like, specific TV shows, and isn't that a lot of how he bonds with his grandpa?
Well, yeah, something? There's the... they talk about Happy Days. His mom makes him sit up and watch The Waltons, I think, or Little House on the Prairie.
Yeah.
And it's just, like, pretty much the only way he interacts with his... Well, that's not true. He talks with these people a whole lot, but everything seems so manufactured and allegorical that the only time that the interaction feels authentic or like he's actually narrating something that could conceivably happen, it's them watching TV together. Happy Days. He wishes that he could watch Starsky and Hutch.
Oh, yeah.
But he has to watch Little House on the Prairie or something. You know, it's just stuff like that over and over again. And I think that, you know, given that he makes this clear, he makes it clear in not only at the afterword, but also in, like, the promo copy, that this isn't really a novel. It's more or less a fictionalized memoir. Mm-hmm. I think it would have been a much more interesting book if he had gotten at, like, the loneliness of being a kid. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's part of the reason why you don't really appreciate stuff that people make for you. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, you're shut up in your own head.
Yeah.
And he never really captures that. Because Eddie, the main character, is always reflecting on, you know, oh, I feel so bad, I made that person suffer, but I have to keep being shitty.
Yeah.
I mean, literally, that thought process occurs over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I was 12, and I couldn't get myself out of the hole that I dug. You know, that kind of thing. But Taylor, he tries to move in with Taylor.
Yeah, that doesn't pan out too well.
No, just doesn't.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's this really well laid out plan where, you know, I'll just tell Taylor's parents that my grandparents have decided I'd be better off living with them.
Yeah.
And that'll work, right? And of course the parents just take him back to his grandparents' house. I guess it's shortly after that the big reveal in the garage happens.
Yeah, yeah, well, his grandfather has, like, what amounts to a breakdown. And, you know, this was another thing, is that as much as these people are almost faultlessly generous and pursue him endlessly, they also, their idea of loving somebody is basically just to be kind of passive-aggressive. Like, nobody sits him down and is like, hey, cut the shit.
Yeah.
They're always like, well, you know, we've sacrificed so much for you. You know, you really ought to feel bad for everything we've done for you. Which never works.
No.
You're not going to make someone love you because they have an obligation to you. Mm-hmm. And that is the recurrent way that they relate to this kid. And so basically he drags Eddie out into the garage. The fucking bike's there. And his grandfather just weeps and cries and basically becomes a shell of the man that he used to be within a space of about 15 minutes. Because Eddie harasses him so much and just calls him a shit heel and things like that. It's just, yeah.
And on a side note, the reveal of the bike that's been in the garage for a year, it's clear that is supposed to be a surprise,
yeah,
in spite of the fact that it isn't in any way,
yeah,
shape, or form.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, from the time they get to the grandparents' house, you know, from the big hints, such as the fact that the grandfather, you know, all through dinner on Christmas night, grandpa's really keyed up about something. And,
yeah,
you know, the grandmother actually says to him, like, no, wait until tomorrow.
Yeah.
And two minor hints, like, all the playing cards are gone. Why are the playing cards? Because they're in the spokes of the bicycle wheels. So from, you know, from the time of the accident onward, you're just sitting there wondering, well, when's the bike going to rear,
yeah,
its head again? And then it finally does. And it also raises the question of, why didn't you give the kid the bike when his mother died and he had to move in with you? Wouldn't,
yeah,
that have been a nice little, hey, I know things are really shitty, you know, at least here's a bike for you.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So I guess that night, the chronology of this book, it just all blurs together, but at some point Eddie decides he's going to run away from home on the bike. And that's where things go, I believe the literary term is bug shit crazy.
Yeah, it kind of develops this sort of Dream of the Rood kind of quality. It's this weird mystical fantasy. He's like riding along in the bicycle, because Taylor, the little wealthy boy, knows backwoods shortcuts to the highway. Anyway, he's pedaling through the woods, and then he gets to this cornfield. He's in cornfield town now, which is danger, as everyone knows. All of a sudden, he sees this giant storm coming for him. Well, if you don't mind, I'll
go right ahead.
I'll mention some choice clips from the cornfield. So at first, he's like, oh, I'm in the cornfield. Man, I hate you, God. And God whispers back, I love you. Come home, Eddie. All is well. Presumably it's more convincing than that voice. And then, all of a sudden, when, like, the storm gets real bad, he hears, like, the Satan voice going, like, you were right, Eddie. God doesn't care. He never has. Strong bad, I guess. Eddie, this is where you belong. The cornfield is your home now. Just this weird fascination with the sinister capacities of the cornfield, which I couldn't help but think of, like, Children of the Corn. And it just struck me as kind of unoriginal.
I like the fact, too, that, you know, his grandfather and, you know, slash dearest friend has been telling him for, you know, half the book, hey, man, you know, straighten up, everything's cool. He doesn't listen. But one sentient whispering cornfield later, and, you know, 5 minutes later, just, oh, man, well, I've been a fuck-up.
Yeah. So he's in the cornfield, and there's this giant storm coming, and Russell shows up, of course. And Russell starts providing even more gnomic and nonsensical advice than he has heretofore. Such as, so I mean, all right, you're standing in a cornfield. And there's a horrible tornadic storm descending on you. What's the one thing to say? Don't fear the storm, Eddie. Fear the cornfield. Yeah, because the prone corn stalks are really the most terrifying thing in this situation. Oh, well, everybody has to weather storms, Eddie. But not everyone has to stay in the cornfield. I couldn't figure out what the cornfield was supposed to be. Was it supposed to be just, like, barren shit? And, like, you know, it's the wasteland? Or is it supposed to be that he doesn't like corn products? I don't know.
Yeah, what Glenn Beck doesn't say is that his mother was actually killed by a thresher.
Flying ear of corn. Swooped out of the sky.
Glenn Beck says at the end of the book, you know, the whole cornfield thing, that was based on a dream I had. Yeah, no shit. It made no sense and was weird.
I mean, I will say that if there ever is a film version of this, I mean, I think that, you know, you could do a pretty good David Lynch version of this movie. Or this book. I mean, I think that the quality of schmaltz underlaid with all these things that don't really make sense, like character motivations that have been completely untethered from anything realistic. Mm-hmm. The cornfield. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could see David Lynch making a creepy cornfield.
The return of German expressionism. Yeah. Glenn Beck's The Christmas Wedding. Well, you know, it may work as a film, but apparently it won't work as a satellite cast live show, because that was a colossal flop.
Oh, I know that.
I found out about that just today, actually. Glenn Beck apparently, he did this one-man show where he, like, talked about the story behind this book and did voices for all the characters. And the article I read, I don't know if this is true, but it said that, like, the theaters it opened at, they had sort of like how some theaters will do, like, live at the Met once a month or something. They did that.
And live, like, at the Beck.
Apparently in Boston, like the city of Boston, 17 people showed up to the theater that was showing it. 17. So apparently it was not quite the hit he had hoped for. But yeah, it's very strange. It takes a... The one thing I can say is that the cornfield sequence was perhaps the only time in the book where I sat back and said, well, I didn't see that coming.
Yeah.
I mean, it's shitty and bad, but I didn't see it coming at the very least.
It's definitely the least predictable thing. Basically, what happens is that he sees this storm, and Russell's premise is that, like, look, storms come and go, but, you know, you can't, like, bad things come and go, but you can't live in a bad world. And so it's this, you know, giant, like, kind of Christian revelation. I mean, I don't know how else you could construe it, but Glenn Beck in his afterword is very coy and, you know, sniveling about it and like, oh, well, I know who Russell is, but who you think Russell is, I don't know. Maybe he's the Dalai Lama. Maybe he's Richard Gere. I'm not sure. You know, like, it's just really aggravating. There is this tremendous coyness about it, despite the fact that Russell is all the time announcing, you know, I am that I am, and things like that. Yeah.
It's Popeye. Let's see Russell. Yeah.
So he basically, like, goes into a swoon, I guess. And then he wakes up. And then, you know, the new reality is on him. And this was shitty. This was awful.
So, what would you say, like, 200 pages of the book is probably devoted to Edward going to the grandparents' farm and, you know, all this misery that befalls him. And
the mom being dead.
Yeah, the mom being dead.
It's supposed to be a full year.
Full year, yeah, that's right. Because he runs away on Christmas, doesn't he?
Yeah.
So after the cornfield incident, he wakes up, and you know what? It was all a dream!
Momsky's there.
Yeah, why, when he crumpled that sweater up on the ball on the floor, he just fell fast asleep and had a dream in which an entire year passed.
And rather, his mom died.
Yeah. And rather than being terrified that he developed an advanced brain tumor, he's just overjoyed that his mom's still alive. And all this sweater stuff. Best sweater ever, and I love everything. And Merry Christmas, Bob Cratchit. And, you know, it's the shittiest cop-out.
Yeah.
And he says at the end of the book, which just pissed me off, he says, like, well, you know, the ending of the book, you know, that there was a dream. That's my gift to you, reader. It's like, well, it's not an earned gift.
No.
It's not, you know, if to say the whole thing was a dream doesn't make it better. It's a cheap cop-out.
Well, I mean, it's another instance of him ripping off from other established forms. I mean, it's basically the It's a Wonderful Life thing.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, what would it be like if you forgot who you were? You know, what would it be like if you weren't, if you'd never existed?
Mm-hmm.
It's just shitty to see a character who is supposed to learn the lesson that you don't need to have, you know, you don't need to have all these things, and maybe there's an inner peace that you should conjure up. And instead, he gets to have everything.
Yeah.
He gets to have his mom, he gets to have the bike, and so it's like, well, if the lesson is that important, and the lesson is that convincing, then he shouldn't need either of those things anymore.
Yeah, he's working at cross purposes with himself. I mean, it totally undermines everything the entire book is supposed to be about.
Right, yeah.
The ending should be that he, you know, he realizes, hey, my grandparents are great. And, it's just pretty much the worst possible ending you could conceive of.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's the reason. You know, people don't talk about the infamous Dallas episode where an entire season turned out to be a dream. They don't still talk about that today because it was a good idea.
Right. You know? Well, and he also turns into just the most insufferable Christmas prig on the planet. Mm-hmm. You know, like his grandfather's like, you know, oh, don't you want to go get the bike? We don't need to get it. I have everything I need right here.
But I spent a lot of money on that bike. Yeah, I'm kidding. You know? Like $200. Come on.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, all the frames don't really fit together conveniently. Mm-hmm. I mean, like an actual grandparent or parent having a kid act like a shithead, and then he goes upstairs and takes a nap, and like he comes back downstairs, and then all of a sudden, like he's, you know, Father Christmas. It's like, man, what the hell's wrong with you? Don't you want a fucking bike? You're saving up for that. What's wrong with you?
What happened? Did you fall upstairs?
Yeah.
Did you hit your head on the corner of the cabinet again?
Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, now that we've talked about the book per se, well, the story per se, there's a couple of sort of supplemental materials that we should talk about. So for one thing, there's a weird campaign ad for John Huntsman at the back.
Yeah.
That's all about how John Huntsman is just the tops. And anything better than a Huntsman.
Apparently John Huntsman will cure cancer in our lifetimes. What this has to do with the rest of the book, I have no fucking idea. But Glenn Beck is very sincere about it, especially since he ends the book with it. It's the last thing in the book.
It's like 5 pages long. It just talks about how great John Huntsman is, mm-hmm. and like how Huntsman Chemical is sweet, and Huntsman's making like Cancer Town into the Ritz-Carlton and stuff. But there was... He goes into an afterword where he basically like pulls the curtain back and he tells you about the real Beck story. And, you know, apparently it wasn't his dad that died. It was his mom that died, and he was living with his dad, and he was a shitheel to his dad. And then eventually they got back together and recorded a new album. I don't know.
Beck to Beck.
Yeah, Jeff Beck and Glenn Beck collaboration, I think. The thing that kind of weirded me out is that, you know, so you did some research on the quality of his mother.
Yeah. So it turns out, I got this from a transcript I found online of an interview he did with Don Imus back when both he and Don Imus had shows that people watched. So apparently Glenn Beck's mother died of a suicide, and she had been an alcoholic and I think a drug addict.
Mm.
And so the last Christmas they had together, when I guess he was about 12, she gave him the sweater, the titular Christmas sweater. And
gave him the sweater.
It's not a euphemism. And so that was, you know. Her final gift to him, crippling guilt for his entire adult life.
Exactly.
And, you know, he really did crumple it into a ball and all that. And and then months later, she killed herself. I think I read somewhere she jumped off of a boat or something, but I might be mistaken on that.
She was Natalie Wood.
The plot thickens. But,
anyway.
So that, you know, these are details that add some more texture to the story.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can't, you know, the famous Hemingway thing about Fitzgerald. He said that Fitzgerald's book suffered as his career went on because you can't give people incorrect parents. Mm-hmm. If you're going to write about somebody, you're going to write about them, especially in a family context, you have to have, if not exactly the same thing, then a reasonable substitute. Mm-hmm. And this idea that Glenn Beck, who is writing about a personality like his own, mm-hmm. but that could have only emerged from a pattern of emotional abuse and guilt and things like that, and then it just spontaneously erupts like some sort of rare orchid in the middle of this happy family, is just incongruous.
Yeah.
And while it may happen in real life, you know, a lot of things happen in real life, the standard of fiction is not met, I don't think.
Well, and it casts the mother in a very different light. If, you know, it's one thing if she can't get him the bike because times are tight. It's another thing if she can't get him the bike because times are tight because, well, you know, booze and drugs ain't free, kid.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
These are very good cuts of meat. What's wrong with you?
Uppers, downers, reds, whites. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, that, you know, the actual story would have been a more interesting one, but, you know.
Well, I think a more rewarding one.
Yeah.
I mean, for his moral.
Well, I have to disagree there, because the real story has the most tragic ending of all, that he becomes Glenn Beck.
And then he turned into Glenn Beck. Well, there was this really weird conclusion to that afterward that I wanted to ask you about. Mm-hmm. Not that you know the answer, but just, you know, your thoughts. So he says that after his mom gave him that sweater, he couldn't get rid of it. And that henceforth, he couldn't get rid of any sweater. And, like, people would give him sweaters. And he'd just freak out and, like, hold on to it for years. Even if it didn't fit him, or even if he hated it. There's just, like, some room full of sweaters or something. Like Bluebeard's castle, but just... Oh, don't go in my sweater room. It's my shame. And he says, quote unquote, this is his big, like, you know, I'm gonna tie it all up. And Glenn Beck, actually, when I've seen him do broadcasts, if you buy into his logic, like, which takes a long time, but if you imagine that you are a Glenn Beck audience member, He's got a good way of tying things up and putting a nice little bow on stuff, you know, or making people provoked at the end of something. This is the way that he ties up basically his life story. I eventually gave away all my sweaters to Goodwill, and I am completely at peace with it. I found that I didn't need them anymore, because it's so warm here. It is just so warm. And that's it. What the fuck does that mean?
Live from hell, it's Glenn Beck.
That's what I thought. I mean, nobody goes, you know, like at the end of a theological story, man, it's hot here, don't need sweaters. And you think, oh, well, obviously it ended well. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, and I didn't know what to make of that. I mean, the last 50 pages of the book are just nonsense anyway. Yeah. It's hard to figure out what any of it means.
Well, I thought that it was promising that the guy who is cited as a recommendation for the Glenn Beck book, The Christmas Sweater, is the best-selling author of The Christmas Box, which leads to one of my final points about this book, which is, you know, right now, folks, at home, in your very, very warm place, bundled in a sweater, you can't see what we're looking at, which is a very, very deep red cover ringed with snowflake designs, and there's a little sweater on the front that looks very effeminate, so probably a 12-year-old boy would not want to wear that. But, you know, the book itself is very small, really. Mm-hmm. It's smaller than, like, an iPad, perhaps even an iPad mini? Mm-hmm. Yes. Would you say so?
Yeah, okay. I would say so.
So it's a tiny old book, and the spacing of the pages is pretty generous. I mean, it's really, really stretched out, and each page has like a border, and there's illustrations and everything. And it reminds me of like when people give books or are attached to books, not because they plan on reading them, but because it's a kind of like fetish object. It's a thing. You know, it's like those elegantly bound volumes of the classics, you know, like that you know you're never going to read because they're leather bound and they look pretty.
Got gilt on the pages.
Yeah.
I could see a lot of people reading this book because they like Glenn Beck and are willing to forgive its many faults, or they're willing to look past the fact that the ending is totally unearned and just find comfort in, oh, well, it all tied together happily.
Yeah.
You know, I think that the person who is going to read this book probably just wants something that's going to be nice and soft and comforting and, you know, yeah, you could think about it, but who cares?
It's really called The Christmas Sweater, for Christ's sake. I mean,
skip ahead here. Would you recommend this book, Greg?
No, I would not. Yeah, no, I can't imagine why you would want to read it. And in fact, I'd be curious to hear your recommendation, Ben, what you would think about it, and whether you have a book that you'd like to recommend.
Well, I would not recommend this book. If for no other reason than if I'm going to read a book that is supposed to teach you how to stop being a shitheel and become a good person, it's not going to be written by Glenn fucking Beck. It's like, hey, did you read that new diet book by Dom DeLuise? I guess it's not that new since he's been dead for 4 or 5 years. But anyway, you see the joke I was going at before I remembered the tragic demise of Dom DeLuise.
Back from the grave.
So no, it's awful, and it's just awful. But as far as what I would recommend instead, due to, I'll blame it on the late illness, I had forgotten that there was the part of the podcast where you recommend another book.
Yeah.
So I had nothing. But you know what I'm going to recommend instead, just because you mentioned it and happened to pass through my head and stick there for some reason? Yeah, Harold and Maude's a real good movie. I think it'll require a little bit of bullshit, but I'm going to tie this in.
Okay.
The story of a young man
who's,
you know, has all these gifts, you know, lavished upon him, but is ultimately unwilling to, you know, he's disenchanted with life, and then he has sex with an old woman and sees that life's worth living, and has a pretty rockin' Cat Stevens soundtrack.
Yeah.
So,
Trouble.
Inexplicably, you should watch Harold and Maude instead of read The Christmas Sweater for reasons.
pretty much do anything but read the Christmas sweater. Go yeah. have sex with an old woman, for that matter.
Yeah, yeah. Come on, it's Christmas time. It's you know, it's about giving, not receiving. Put a smile on that old gal's face. I don't know. Would say something, Greg, before I keep talking.
My recommendation is Cannonball Run.
Man, have you seen that Dom DeLuise? When's his star gonna stop rising?
Now, I guess well, there's a couple different tacks you could take. Depends on what you're interested in. There's, of course, Marcel Mauss's compelling meditation on gift giving and the Quaquito potlatch called The Gift. So if you're if you're into that,
like most Glenn Beck fans are,
I would actually recommend one of my favoriteest books in the whole world. Perhaps the book that reignited my passion for reading, which is Brideshead Revisited by Evelyn Waugh. So in Brideshead Revisited, a young man goes off to college and he meets this guy. It is very heavily hinted that they have an affair. He sort of becomes entranced with this guy's family. And as he falls in love with not only the guy, but also like the entire family, his friend sort of falls apart and becomes an alcoholic and is manic depressive and just all these things. And it's a very interesting book. It does not flinch to show a great deal of sadness about growing up and things like that. And the reason why I can recommend it is because the principal blow up where Sebastian Flight, the young lord, disgraces himself in particular happens at Christmas. So.
Similar vein, Die Hard. It's a Christmas movie.
Ernest Goes to Christmas.
Yeah, Ernest Saves Christmas is the weakest of the Ernest series. I think we can all agree.
Yeah. All right, folks.
But, yeah. So, I guess the next episode will be doing that Eat, Pray, Love thing.
Yeah,
we're,
man.
We're coming back to that. But we hope you enjoyed this Christmassy episode of Cannon Fodder.
We got a date with Santa, folks.
Yeah.
So, good luck.
I hope I get that bicycle I want.
I don't know, Ben. I've been working on your Christmas present right in front of you. You don't even know it.
Uh-oh. Well, I hope it's not a fucking sweater.
Well, it's not a sweater. It's a fucking sweater, Ben.
Well, I got a date with an old gal tonight, so I'm in good shape. Hey, thanks to our old pal Ryan Browning for the use of his song Destroyer, which bookends our increasingly strange podcast. You can download that song and more great songs from SewnTogetherRecords.com.
And you should.
And you absolutely should.
Very much so.
Who else do I... Oh, go to my website, yeah. BenRWilliams.com. Follow me on Twitter at Ben R. Williams. Follow Greg occasionally on Twitter at Old Jawbone. And send us an email to cannonfodderpod@gmail.com. Mm-hmm. And we do receive emails.
We do. We've been getting pretty steady volume throughout the podcast tenure.
Yeah, and it's really nice. And we always love to hear from you. And sincerely, I don't mean to get schmaltzy around Christmas time, but it really sincerely means a lot.
Yeah. It's always great to hear from people. And in fact, a little Christmas party entertaining recommendation, when you have people over, especially the folks, just put on a little Cannon Fodder. Maybe have that playing in the background.
Yeah.
You know, instead of Dean Martin, Cannon Fodder.
Yeah.
I think so.
I think, just heave those Burl Ives records into the trash where they belong. Listen to us.
Well, good night, folks, and a very Merry Christmas and other holidays associated with the solstice.
Have a happy Kwanzaa, everybody. Good night.